Kate is interviewing David Morris on 4th February 1972 at Meudon.
Well, just to start off, maybe you could tell me what you know about Japanese radio astronomy. You said that they do mainly solar work.
Well, so far, until now, yes, but they're trying very hard to get into non-solar work. They've built a 6-millimeter wave telescope. They've been very short of funds. They've had built it with their own hands. I think they say they claim it cost them $20,000, and they're trying to start off by looking for paraformaldehyde.
Oh, I see. They're trying to get the molecule.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And this is really just a rehearsal, I think, to get some experience, because they really plan to build a 45-meter dish to a couple of millimeters or so.
Well, let's go back a little bit. We were just talking to this Norwegian fellow. What was his name?
Elgroy.
What was the name of the astronomer that went from Cornell, or the radio engineer, I guess, to Japan?
Hatanaka.
H-A... 51 or so.
Yes, yes.
And he sort of started them.
Yes, I think so. I think the next two people involved were Akabane and Takakura. Takakura has always been interested in the theoretical side.
Yeah.
And Akabane has moved. He's been responsible, I guess, for moving into the, trying to get into the molecular line business. I think most of the solar radio astronomy was done at the Tokyo Astronomical Observatory originally, and there's still a lot of old equipment just lying around, rusting and abandoned. And I don't think there are any solar observations made there now. No radio observations, that is. They do make some optical observations.
Where else have they had some of these solar arrays besides Tokyo?
Well, there's what's called the Institute for Atmospherics, which is near Nagoya. I think it's part of Nagoya University, but it's in a separate town called Toyokawa, I think. And there's a guy there called Tanaka, who, I don't know, I don't think he's ever worked outside Tokyo. I was surprised, his English was very good. But I don't think he's ever worked outside Japan, that is. And he's got a very nice compound interferometer, which works at, I think, 10 centimeters. And also another 3 centimeters. And I think the 10-centimeter one is very complicated, very sophisticated, and it produces a picture of the sun in radio once a day, I think, at noon.
I see. And what's the resolution?
It's certainly better than 3 minutes of arc. Maybe 1 minute, I've forgotten, but it's in that range.
Yeah. And where else do they have facilities besides Nagoya?
Well, Tokyo Astronomical Observatory have a site up in the mountains where they've just completed this compound interferometer with a similar sort of resolution, operating at 160 megahertz. And this is it's a north-south and an east-west compound interferometer, so it gives two fan beams. It doesn't actually produce an image. And they also have just completed a millimeter interferometer with a similar resolution at this site. I think it's about 4,000 feet. And then one of the people that was at Tokyo has gone to Nagoya, this Kawabata, his name. He's professor of astronomy or something like that at Nagoya. And he's just completed, I think maybe a year ago, yet another compound interferometer. Maybe 17 gigahertz, I'm not sure.
But now it sounds like up until 5 years ago, though, there were just the two main ones in Nagoya and Tokyo. And then the last 5 years, they've been quite as
supportive
of building.
Yeah, yes, yes, that's right.
I suppose coinciding with the economic boom.
Probably, yeah, yeah.
Okay, but they haven't really done any observational work besides solar stuff.
No, I don't think so.
But you said they're hoping to build this big dish. I'm just gonna think of money to dig it.
Well, they seem rather confident about it. They claim they've got a good design. Mitsubishi, I think they're going to build the thing.
Uh-huh.
Just when I left, they were doing some site testing. They had some little receivers they built. Just been checking the water vapor.
71.
End of 71.
Well, let's go back to your own. Where you worked. You say you got your degree at Jodrell?
That's right.
And what era was this? What was going on in those days?
Well, at that time, we were trying to measure the angular size of radio sources. Since that time, there's been a continuing program. General Bank to try and get increasing the large resolution and
meeting wavelengths.
This is a radio link interferometer.
And when you say we, who are you?
Well, I guess Humphrey Brown probably started all this. And in the early days, he and Jennison and Dasgupta made some observations. And of course, this is how the intensity interferometer came to be invented, of course. Probably heard all about this anyway.
No, I don't think I have. Please tell.
I suppose it must have been in the early 50s. The story is that Humphrey Brown and Twiss, probably. I'm not sure where Twiss started and all this. Well, people wanted to measure the angular size of radio stars. I think maybe in the early days they thought that radio stars really were radio stars and they'd be extremely small angular size. So, of course, this was the day before videotape recorders and atomic clocks. And they thought they'd have to use intercontinental baselines. So that.
And they're working at very long wavelengths too.
Yeah, right. So that they would. I'm trying to find some technique to make this possible.
Oops.
And of course, perhaps it's just a stone. Yeah,
is it a microphone or something?
No.
Okay. No. Sorry. So I'm looking for a technique
to get over the local oscillator problem.
Right.
The problem of getting coherent local oscillators above antennas. And so Henry Brown came up with this idea of why the hell not work oscillators anyway,
right.
So essentially, and just correlate the variations in intensity of the two antennas. And this idea was tested, and I think he and Jennison and Dasgupta, who was some Indian, I don't know what happened to him, he went back to India and Brad can probably tell you where he is.
He may resurface.
Yeah, I don't know what he sort of disappeared from sight as far as I know. I think they tried this out on Cassiopeia and Cygnus and so on.
This is now about what year?
Oh, it's been the early 50s, I think. I can't remember exactly. And then at the same time, they used conventional interferometers on galactic sources, supernova remnants and so on. And this has developed continuously since then.
But now, did the intensity interferometry work?
It worked.
And where was that published?
I can't remember.
Well, I can find it.
But there was certainly, this led to the optical version. And there were a series of articles in in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, I think it was, by Henry Brown and Twiss, on the complicated theory of quantum mechanical.
Yeah, I'm
familiar with those. So, and I'm sure they will refer to the radio. You can get back to the radio from those.
And the next step, I guess, was going to the radio links.
Yeah, well, of course, the intensity interferometer suffers from a signal to noise problem. And so it was much more feasible for weaker sources to try and use radio links. And I was involved in the early stages of this. When I went to Jodrell, they were building what they call the Mark 1 there.
Right.
The 250-foot stereo. And one of the first experiments they wanted to put on this, to use this dish for, was they wanted to do a survey of the angular sizes of, you know, a few hundred radio sources. So I spent most of my time there. Well, the first year I was there, I finished up the program which had already started. I think they were just measuring about 20 sources. And we found some of these sources. We put an upper limit of 20 seconds of arc on their size, which was, we thought we were doing pretty well at that time.
Well, there was no one else in the world doing this sort of thing at the time, is that true?
Not quite true. I think Mills was trying to do some work. Though, I'm not sure much of that was ever published. I don't know why. He was using one arm of the Mills Cross, and the original Mills Cross of 85 megahertz. And some portable. I think we may have been able to print on that, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure. And it turned out that one or two of these things were actually quasars, because they hadn't been identified then.
Yeah, which ones?
It was 3C147, 3C196.
I see.
Something to mine. And at the largest spacing, which was 10 kilometers, we had in those days, these things weren't resolved, so we said they must be less than 20 seconds on. And, Harlan and Company were already talking about cosmological implications of these things. As sources got more and more distant, they might even get. There might be a minimum angular size, and might start getting bigger again.
Yeah.
Depending on the cosmology and so on. So that was one of the reasons for doing all this.
This is now around 58 or something like that.
Yes, that's right. Yes. 59 I left. And, yeah, Erstein Eldred, who we just spoke to from Oslo. He was at Jodrell for 1 year then. And we were working in equipment for. It was going to be a multi-station interferometer, three separations. So a fairly rapid survey of the angular size of a few hundred sources could be done. And that was made subsequently, I think, in the early 60s. Maybe Brown and Palmer and Allen, people like that. So most of the time I was a job, I just spent 4 minutes in the electronic center. And then I went to Caltech.
Excuse me, I think this would be a good point to break, because
it's exactly.
One problem now was the line
that we started with.
Henry Brown and Twist started out with laboratory experiments. And then they did an experiment using two searchlight mirrors. And I think signal to noise ratio has always been a problem.
Was this a Jodrell bank?
This is a Jodrell bank, yeah. And Henry got money from, I think, mainly British sources. They went to Australia for good observing conditions, and also because I think the brightest stars tend to be the brightest blue stars, which are the ones photomultipliers are more sensitive to.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be in the southern hemisphere. So I think that's why they ended up in Australia. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and let me just record one other thing. This book by Lovell, what was it called?
The Story of Jodrell Bank.
Right, which tells about his difficulties in building the telescope and technical difficulties. I need to check that.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so you've talked about your time at Jodrell, and then you went to Caltech. Am I correct? And what did you work on there?
Well, when I arrived at Caltech, the 290-foot dishes had just been completed.
This was what year?
It was essentially 1960, the beginning of 1960, January 1960, essentially. And so I guess I was employed there because it was thought I was using the red interferometers. And For my first year there, I more or less lived there.